Hi, everyone. I'm John Carson, the Director of the Office of Public Engagement here at the White House. And today on World AIDS Day, we wanted to take the opportunity to introduce you to members of the team of the President's administration who are working on these issues day in and day out, to talk about some special announcements that were made today, but also use that as an opportunity to answer your questions, both on those announcements, but on the work that this administration and others are doing on AIDS every day of the year. But to start out, before we take some questions, and we've gotten some fantastic questions, let's introduce you to our panel here today and hear a little bit about from them the work that they're doing, but also the announcements that the President was able to make today. We'll start with Eric Goosby, the Ambassador to the Office of Global AIDS with PEPFAR.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. We run the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. The Obama administration has focused on the issues that were started in 2004 under President Bush. We've continued to expand the services that focus on prevention, care, and treatment for populations that are heavily impacted by HIV/AIDS throughout the globe. We now work in 88 countries, are treating close to 4 million people with antiretroviral drugs, having over 13 million people who are in care and treatment, have tested over 40 million people in the last year alone, and continue to do good work that largely saves people's lives.
Okay. And let's turn it over to Jeff Crowley, the Director of the President's Office of National AIDS Policy.
Thank you, John. Yeah, so when President Obama came into office, one of the first things he tasked us with doing is developing a national HIV/AIDS strategy. So now we have a roadmap for collective action for all parties to respond to the domestic epidemic. And you know, this is an exciting moment. You know, I think a lot of us believe that the science and other things that we have now really create new opportunities to prevent more HIV infections, but get every person living with HIV to learn their HIV status, to link to care, retained in care, and really get the maximum benefits of treatment. So today, as part of this progress, the President announced $50 million of new money for the Ryan-wide HIV/AIDS program. Of that, $15 million will be for the Part C program, which supports about 350 medical clinics across the country. And this is really the front line of the HIV epidemic. It's where doctors and nurses, other medical providers are providing life-saving support for people with HIV. So this support will go a long way to make sure we bolster these clinics and this healthcare system. The other $35 million is to address an issue within the AIDS Drug Assistance Programs, which are state-run programs where there's currently been waiting lists in some states for access to HIV medications. Now, most of these people on these waiting lists are getting assistance through pharmaceutical company programs, but we really want to bolster this program as much as possible. So we're providing this extra support that will actually support nearly 3,000 more people to get the life-saving drugs they need.
Excellent. And Gail Smith, Special Assistant to the President for Development at the National Security Staff.
Thanks, John. My office here at the White House works with a whole range of agencies, and we've had the pleasure these last few months working with Dr. Goosby and his team and others across the U.S. government to pull together what was the event this morning with the announcements by the President of, I think, a real vision of how Americans across the political spectrum, inside and outside of government, working with others around the world, can pull together to marry the kind of hope and aspiration we all have with the science that's telling us what works to reduce worldwide the level of HIV infections and really turn the corner on this epidemic. So it's been my pleasure. I'll leave it to Dr. Goosby to explain in more detail as we get questions what some of those announcements are on the international side.
Before we dive into questions, I'd just like to ask, for those of you who have spent so many years working on the HIV/AIDS epidemic, what was it like to see the event today that the President attended with the One Campaign, with President Bush, who made this a priority, with so many stakeholders? Just any personal thoughts from that experience today?
Well, for me, I've been addressing this epidemic really since 1981. I started as a physician in San Francisco at San Francisco General Hospital and had gone through with my own patient population more than 500 deaths of people who had not benefited from antiretroviral drugs. Knew them, went through their lives, and went through multiple opportunistic infections, multiple hospitalizations, and then finally the terminal phase. that moment when President Obama spoke to adding another 2 million people to treatment, focusing on the domestic issues in our own country, to close those gaps of access and retention, I reflected on all of those people who were not here for that moment. Mm-hmm. So it was a personal moment for me.
Jeff, or
yeah? Yeah, I mean, I would just say, you know, we now have a 30-year history of HIV. And, you know, early our government didn't respond effectively. Other things didn't happen, but we've really come a long way. So to see really this bipartisan approach, I think it's remarkable how, you know, there are still issues that could divide us, but this is an area where we've all come together and we don't have to fight over this. There's been broad bipartisan support for both global AIDS but also domestic AIDS. And just to see that come together as we try to move forward is really exciting.
Excellent. Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that's been said. I think for me it was three things. I think that it's bipartisanship, it's nonpartisanship. It is that, again, everybody coming together, we can make a difference. I think the second thing is the moment we have, given kind of alignment of the stars, this science and evidence that tells us that we know what works and we can invest in what works. The diversity of people who are committed to this, the stepping up to the plate of leaders in the developing world, whether in governments or in rural villages. So all of those things coming together to mean we can make a great leap forward. I think the third thing is it has been 30 years, and I remember when nobody would say AIDS, and I remember when people died alone and in isolation. I remember when people started talking about the numbers for HIV/AIDS in Africa. I was living in Africa at the time, and they were unimaginable. And I think, as the president said today, it was a time when I think people hoped and people were determined to do something, but had no idea whether we would come out of that very dark tunnel. And I think the power of today was all the evidence is that there's light at the end of that tunnel and we're moving very quickly towards it.
Well, thank you. I just want to say thanks to the three of you for the work you've done for many years to make today possible and our commitment to the work that lies ahead. I'll start with a question from Twitter, which is, I think, a good one. A number of you mentioned the different stakeholders that are involved in how we've gotten to where we are and where we need to go. And Emily V. Carson asks, not related, that I know of anyway, how do you plan to involve youth as stakeholders in the fight to end HIV and AIDS?
So maybe I'll start domestically. So we, as I said, the president tasked us with developing a national HIV/AIDS strategy. And one of the things we did from the outset is really try to say it's not our federal strategy, it's a national strategy. So we had a broad consultation process. We had a meeting here at the White House with young people, both living with HIV, others, and people that work with youth. But we also engaged in a series of community discussions across the country. Every step of the way, we've tried to engage as many different voices as possible, including young people. But you know, one of the key messages for us, and you know, the president has said this, we can't do it alone at the federal level. So we need states to be involved, local governments, but also the community. People shouldn't be waiting for us to engage them. They should do what needs to be done in their states and local communities and engage us as well.
Excellent.
I would just add just to amplify on Jeff's comments that our ability to keep and hold our partner countries accountable, to continue to invest in their people through programs such as HIV/AIDS and TB-related activities is largely related to the community's ability to be that voice that holds an expectation and follows through for the accountability to be sustained. That largely comes from our youth, our young people. We have started things that they will finish, and it's really gratifying that someone in that age group is seen a connection to this work because they will be the generation that completes it.
Excellent. We also have a group with us here in the audience today. Let's see if there's any questions from anyone in our audience would like to ask.
Hi, my name is Hector Vargas. I'm with the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, which is an organization that started in 1981, largely in call for the advocacy and services for people with HIV and AIDS. My question is about biomedical prevention efforts for HIV. I think we've all been encouraged recently by the success of certain trials and concerned by some more recent results. But I guess my question is how you see these biomedical prevention trials fitting into the larger PEPFAR program and the U.S. government's role in supporting those kinds of trials.
Well, that's a great question. We see them being the critical ingredient that has informed us as to how to prioritize our prevention interventions for specific populations, to allow us to better interface our services in front of populations that are hard to get in front of, those that are discriminated against and ostracized from accessing services need to be sought out differently, need to be identified and entered and retained with different strategies. Safe space needs to be created so the concerns around revealing themselves to family, community are minimized and allow for a shift in the stigma that's associated to that really becomes a huge barrier for people, especially in the countries that we work, to access care. That creates a huge disparity in when people enter. They enter at a later stage of disease, and as a result, don't benefit as much from the interventions that we have available.
If I could, you know, just amplify that domestically, I mean, one of the points I would like to make is some of our biggest successes in HIV prevention have been biomedical interventions. We've made the blood supply safe, so people with hemophilia don't get HIV. We've largely eliminated the problem of newborns being born with HIV in this country because of biomedical interventions. There's a whole range of areas. Clean syringes have caused infections among injection drug users in the United States to fall by 80% or more. So those have been very effective. But we shouldn't think of this as choosing behavioral interventions over biomedical as though they're in competition. What we think we need to do is recognize that we have a broad range of tools and we need to put them together in smart ways. The CDC has identified, or their new approach is called high impact prevention, and it's really about identifying some really high priority interventions that are critically important everywhere. HIV testing, getting people in treatment, but also recognizing there's a role for behavioral interventions. Some of these behavioral interventions, there are questions about, with limited resources, how can we take them to scale? I think we would emphasize getting to scale on interventions for people living with HIV, because it's a much smaller population, and then really thinking about those interventions for HIV negative individuals, which are the ones that can really get to large numbers of people. You know, so it's not about saying one is better than the other, but how can we put them together in smart ways? And I think we would recognize that the best combinations might vary for different populations. So what you'd want to do for young black gay men might be different than heterosexual Latinas, for example. You know, we just need to get smart about this.
For those of you following online, we are getting some great questions in, but you can send us more via Twitter using the hashtag WHChat or following us on Facebook at White House Live. A couple interesting questions we've received about digging in a little more on the funding. David Holtgrave asks, it's wonderful news that the president's committed $50 million to HIV treatment and care in the U.S. Is this funding new money? Is it redirected funding? If it is redirected, what's the source of the $50 million? Are there activities that are being halted to make it available? A few questions on those details.
Yeah, so the $50 million we announced for domestic HIV are new AIDS resources. This is an allocation that we have the discretionary authority to make through the Prevention and Public Health Fund.
Excellent.
So it's new money.
Okay. A little more globally, Meredith asks, what specifically is the Obama administration doing to respond to the recent announcement by the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria that it's canceled its next funding round due to financial constraints?
I can start with that. It's obviously a focus of concern. It's not canceled, it is postponed or deferred. And now I don't want in any way want to minimize the seriousness of that. I think the president spoke to that this morning. First and foremost, we fully intend to honor our commitment to the fund, which was a multi-year commitment. We're its largest donor. He called on other countries to honor their commitments. This happens not infrequently in the world of development, that pledges are made and there's often the catch-up is not as swift as it should be. The third thing the president pointed to was the importance of countries like China that are now emerging market countries. And China, in fact, has said that they're now going to cover more of their own domestic HIV financial requirements, but to also become donors, because there's a need for new and traditional donors to sustain that fund. I think in terms of what we will do about it, and I think it's not just us, I think all the donors to the fund are concerned about this, as are the many countries that partner with the fund, is work very aggressively to make sure that those commitments are met that have already been put out there and that new commitments are made so that the fund can sustain and expand the important work it's done. Mm-hmm. Eric, I don't know if you want to
That really add does to cover that. The bulk of the issues. I think the idea that it is a postponement of round 11, that all of the programs that are being funded through rounds 1 through 10 will be continued is part of that decision. The desire to also transform the Global Fund at this moment into a non-round driven process so countries can access these resources without this huge burden of preparation that goes into the plan and the application was also part of this reform effort. So this really does kick us into a transition that is going to make these resources go to those who need them most more easily.
Excellent. I would turn to our audience. Any other questions from the folks who've joined us here today?
Hi. My name is Pranessa Seal, and I am the founder CEO of The Balm in Gilead, 23 years of building the capacity of faith communities to address HIV and AIDS. I have three points that I'm going to do very briefly. One is stigma, that with all of this wonderful science, more money, stigma is still a major, major factor in this epidemic globally, here at home and around the world. And how might we really systematically go about addressing stigma in ways that we haven't thought of yet? Number two is having the responsibility of working both domestically and globally. We know that PEPFAR has produced some great evidence-based interventions everywhere. However, they are culturally specific, which is great, and they are country specific. Some of these interventions, many of them, can be used in other areas. I would love to be able to take some of those interventions from Tanzania or South Africa and bring them right here at home. Mm. Might there be a reservoir where we can look at how we can use evidence-based models that are working in other countries in rural villages and be able to tailor them to places specifically right here, you know, at home and in other areas. And lastly, sustainability. I know that one of PEPFAR's mandate is sustainability and rolling programs over to indigenous organizations in country. How is that going? What are the challenges and what are some of the successes?
Well, those are all, I guess I'll start on those. Those are all terrific. Thank you, Bishop. I think that the ability to address stigma really occurs when we start to have people not associate HIV, AIDS with death. I have never seen stigma diminish until there is a substantial diminution in the number of people who are dying. Once that starts, I think empowering those who are using the services to be vocal by creating safe spaces for them to be seen and embraced in the workplace, in their communities, to make that an active effort. I know the work that you've done for 23 years has focused much on that domestically as well as internationally. But it is a critical piece. And over time, you see it wane. I don't have any magic bullet for stigma, but I know those are two critical ingredients for it. In terms of PEPFAR's models that really do have application elsewhere, Jeff and the national strategy in the domestic side actually had a component that looked at lessons learned from PEPFAR to try to bring back into the United States to apply to settings, as you've alluded to, that really would benefit from the same type of strategy in a different setting. We need to do more of that is the honest truth of it. We don't do it enough. There are many lessons that I know you've witnessed and participated in where it is definitely transportable, and we should take advantage of that. In terms of your last question about our ability to sustain, it's something we worry about a lot. President Obama, Secretary Clinton, on day one when I started, was how can we make sure these programs are there for the duration, are there for the entire time that they're needed, and are not only a transport of kind of an expat cadre of individuals who are parachuted down to do the work. We, at the same time, want to maintain quality, must maintain quality because of the commitments we've made to the people who use these services, and we want to expand capacity so the countries, both civil society and governments, can develop the skill set to monitor, manage, and correct these programs as needs change within the population. So that capacity expansion has manifested itself in us supporting medical schools, nursing schools, ministries of health in ways that are very aggressively trying to transfer the ability to do surveillance, to understand scientific methodology in the doctor, in the nurse, so they begin to think and act that way, to create and infuse an intellectual honesty that is self-sustaining, that you can't ensure by standards or laws. It has to come from within the institutions that are part of the country. So we're very aggressively focusing on that.
If I could just add, so I think there's a number of things we need to do. And the first, I think, you know, comes from presidential leadership. So President Obama has spoken about stigma in the past on a number of occasions. And I think this is something he personally gets. As a candidate, you probably know he was tested for HIV in Kenya. He said at the time he was doing that to lessen stigma. As president, we sort of rebroadcast that, and he gave a message on a testing day saying, now that I'm president, it's still important that we both get tested for HIV but address stigma. But you know, his words today are also important. You know, in his remarks, he talked about the remarkable increases in infection rates among young black gay men, and he said, when they're increasing by 50% in 3 years, we need to do more to show them their lives matter. He talked about Latinos dying sooner. Talked about black women feeling invisible even though they make up more than half of all new infections among women. So I think just him talking about it hopefully will create an opportunity for other people to have some of these conversations about what is going on in our communities. But there's other parts of this response. I think civil rights enforcement is a critical part of it. You know, in some cases there are horrible things happen, but we already have laws. You know, and some there's forms of illegal discrimination. We just need to pursue that. So the Department of Justice has been working hard and has brought a number of lawsuits. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has pursued cases of employment discrimination against people with HIV. But you know, there's another element that really isn't about what the government's doing, it's about what the public is doing. You know, I got my start in AIDS advocacy at the National Association of People with AIDS, and we ran a speakers bureau. And there's few things that are more effective than having people living with HIV disclose their status and talk about that. You know, our Presidential Advisory Council on HIV AIDS, in our national strategy, we asked them to look at the issue of disclosure and say, how can we help make it safer and easier for people to disclose their status, because that, we think, is an important part of it. Now, just very quickly on your second question about, you know, evidence-based models and how can we, you know, engage in this knowledge transfer, I just make the point that I do think, as Ambassador Goosby said, we've started this conversation that needs to continue. But with the International AIDS Conference coming back to Washington for the first time in more than 20 years, it's a great opportunity for, certainly for an American audience, to interact with a whole range of people that they wouldn't normally have that opportunity. And we hope that there will be a lot of knowledge transfer in both directions, but especially in a way that can benefit American communities.
Excellent. Let's go back to some of the questions we're getting in on Twitter. A few more on the international side, I think, that tie together PEPFAR's work with some of our larger development goals. One question, and Gail, I know we've talked before about dealing with tough situations in the context of conflict. So the question from KF0913 is, how can we prevent the spread of HIV in conflict areas like the DRC where rape is so persistent?
That's a great question, and it's really tough to do. I think you got to do three things. One is not shy away from running HIV and other health programs, even in a conflict. There's a tendency sometimes, I think, for people to feel that this country's in conflict, so we can't really do anything, so we'll just put on pause until the war is over. Well, South Sudan just came out of a conflict that actually started in 1955. The Democratic Republic of the Congo has been at war for many, many years now. So you've got to start where you can. That's number one. And even knowing that you're not going to be as effective as you would be in a more peaceful setting. The second is to tackle this issue of rape head on. There's some debate about whether we are seeing more incidents or a greater incidence of rape or just more reporting of it. I suspect it's probably a bit of both. But a lot of it is the latter, is that we're getting consistent reports about rape in the Congo and Zimbabwe and a host of other environments, not exclusively conflict, but often conflict environments. There's some fabulous work being done on that, and I think some of the best is actually from NGOs on the ground, where women and men are doing the kind of education they need to do of women about their rights, getting the laws on the books, but also some very in-your-face education of men and commanders and fighters about what rape is and what we need to do about it. The second gets to something that Jeff referenced in the context of civil rights here, but that is that there's got to be accountability for rape as a crime against an individual, and in some cases where we see it exponentially, a crime against humanity. And I think we're seeing some but insufficient progress on that up to now. I think the third and last thing, and this is where it's, I don't want to overstate it, but I think there's an important moment here. As we're seeing the emergence of overwhelming critical mass in Africa in terms of political leadership on HIV and AIDS, from people, from communities, and from presidents, which is not to say that stigma isn't still there, it is. But the balance is tipping. So you've got more leaders than not talking about HIV and AIDS in a comfortable, straightforward way. You've got more and more women and young people and men talking about it. One of the things that's happening is people are reaching out from country to country. So you see in different countries, they are turning to other countries. Some turn to Uganda. How did you do what you were doing? What can we do? Some turn to Rwanda. Some turn to Tanzania, to Ethiopia. And I think that's the third way we start to get to this, is that sharing of knowledge and experience of, you had a war, you had to deal with HIV and AIDS, what did you do, can you send some people here? All of that said, I would say that in the international context, this is the single hardest space in which to operate. Those environments where you've got lawlessness, conflict, you don't have the protections, you don't have the institutions.
I would just echo what both of my colleagues have said. PEPFAR has taken this on a programmatic level with a gender-based violence effort that we have done in DRC, where the rape victims are identified in transient refugee camps and in the community. They are taken, counseled, tested for sexually transmitted diseases, for HIV, are then treated for them. And given counseling and psychological support that goes on for a number of weeks afterward. They are referred into legal care, but that needs to be strengthened. Most of the women who've been victimized are afraid to really press charges, and I think that that needs to be dealt with better. I think that these responses are now being distributed through all of the PEPFAR programs in regions where it is epidemic, and are available in about half of areas where it's not epidemic. The strategy is to really cover all of the PEPFAR programs' platforms to carry a gender-based violence response.
So staying in the international sphere for a minute, we've got a couple questions on the other environmental and disease factors that play into this. A number of questions on how we're tackling tuberculosis, which interacts with many people dealing with HIV/AIDS in developing countries. And here's an interesting question. What is the government doing to bring clean H2O to developing nations? Access to clean water prevents easily preventable diseases that can kill HIV/AIDS patients. I have to admit, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras working on clean water projects and didn't always think of that connection of how. So any thoughts on those two areas?
Well, I would say that clean water is a critical component to any healthcare delivery system and often undermines it. Diarrheal reed diseases are largely carried through that route. USAID has strategies for clean water development in both kind of post-catastrophe like earthquakes as well as in post-conflict settings. But I am not in the PEPFAR arena. We don't really focus on the clean water strategy.
I think, you know, one of the things that we found coming in is that the great thing was we had this thing called PEPFAR, which is this robust, laser-like focus on HIV and AIDS. We also had a malaria initiative. But what we also found is that, you know, people get more than one disease at a time. And we were kind of stovepiped. I mean, we had what people talk about as vertical programming, so that if you had HIV, you went to a clinic and were in one program or under one project. If you had TB, you were under another, so on and so forth. So one of the things we have tried to do is, while keeping that focus on HIV and AIDS, Eric used the term platforms, is think about how do we use that platform as the foundation from which we can address a number of other things. So that if a patient arrives at a clinic and has HIV, he or she doesn't get turned away because they've also got malaria, and we don't do that here, right? So how do you bring those pieces together? The great thing about that is you also get savings when you start bringing those things together. The second thing, Eric mentioned USAID, is to think about how we make those connections so that in many of those places where we've got this burgeoning health capacity built on PEPFAR program or platforms and building out, how do you marry that up to what you're doing on clean water and sanitation? Because there is a direct causal effect. And it's doing the kind of knitting together of these different interventions that collectively add up to something called development that we've tried to get much better at. And I think we've gotten much better at. And I think that's where the victory comes from, is when you look holistically at communities and people and knit these different pieces together. But I think it's something we've done a good job of.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's go back to our audience to see if there's additional questions that you'd like to ask the panel.
Good afternoon. I'm Cornelius Baker, and I'm a member of the President's Council on HIV and AIDS. And just like to thank you for all of your leadership. I also work at FHI 360 and the National Black Gay Men's Advocacy Coalition. So today's talk by the President, and obviously your responses here today, have been really gratifying and have shown the tremendous American leadership to the fight against AIDS that's helped us advance to where we are. But going back to Hector's earlier question on where we are in biomedical prevention trials, we also have wonderful results coming out of these trials that really point to what has been discussed over today in the past few weeks as the beginning of the end of AIDS, at the same time that we're in a worldwide financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And so we have this great moral dilemma right now, in that we possibly have the tools that can help us end AIDS in many communities, but perhaps not the money or the will to do it. What do we say to people in our country and around the world at this moment as we're telling them about these great advances of science? How do we move forward with their implementation?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to start. I mean, the first thing is that on the domestic side, a lot of our opportunities is that we have both short-term issues and long-term issues. And, you know, President Obama worked so hard to enact the Affordable Care Act, and that's going to lead to a major expansion in insurance coverage for all Americans, but it's also going to be a great coverage expansion for people living with HIV. And so that, I think, will add some long-term stability on the care side of things. We're still going to need a Ryan White program that'll provide, you know, that'll provide supplemental support. But by putting more of the burden of financing HIV-related healthcare in the insurance system, I think that does, you know, help make things more sustainable. The process we went through in developing our national HIV/AIDS strategy, in part, was to say, let's take a fresh look at what we're doing, identify the priorities, so that we can make a case to the American people about if we get new investments for HIV prevention and care and research, we can assure them that it'll pay off. And so I think we've done our homework, and we've shown we've really set some clear priorities. So I think we've done the hard part, but I think you're right. This isn't a vacuum. There will be resource challenges going forward, but I think we, you know, have set the right priorities to move forward.
I'm ridiculously optimistic, just as a matter of choice. And I think you're absolutely right that it's a tough moment, but I think we've got some real powerful things to work with. I think the first is, you know, you got to get people's attention first, because the natural inclination is to say, these are financially hard times, so I'm going to take care of me and mine, and I shouldn't, and we as a nation shouldn't, or we as a state or as a community shouldn't be thinking about anybody else. But when you turn that on its head and point out to people that whether it's in Washington or Ohio or California, a healthier community is a more productive community. A more productive community is generally a safer community. So there is a win in it, even if it's not direct. And that's true globally. I think the second thing is that these are really good investments. And I don't mean that in a crass sense. I mean that in the sense that what we are seeing is that there are things that work. And if we put resources behind those things that work, we get outcomes. We get healthier, more productive, safer communities. We get healthier, more productive, safer countries, which means we spend less dealing with unsafe, unhealthy, unproductive countries. I mean, you know, the converse is true. I think the third point is that science that you spoke to that I think everybody's been focused on, and a lot of the work that, for example, PEPFAR has done, has shown us that we know how to be efficient. We know how to get real value for money. And one of the great stories out of today is that one of the reasons we've got more people on treatment is we're better and smarter at what we're doing. And so there's a story about, I think, the responsible and effective stewardship of public funds. I think the last point I would make, and this is a tough one, it's probably a romantic one, but I imagine it's one that you and others share, which is that very simple truth that, you know, if you don't reach out to your community won't reach back to you. And so we've all got an obligation and an opportunity to do that. And on this day, I would remind people that the reason those horrible, horrible moments early in this epidemic in this country turned around was because communities came together and formed organizations like yours and said, we're going to take care of each other. So I think it's pushing on those powerful stories of things we've done before and showing that it's efficient, we get a real return. And how could you not do otherwise?
Yes. I can have nothing to add to that.
Well, a different kind of question from Marie Palin. Looking forward, how is it possible, in front of such good information about new effective treatments, the good news that we've heard today, to make sure that people, mostly young people, don't mix this up with some notion that HIV/AIDS is over, not seeing it as a threat, not seeing it as a scourge, and potentially increasing infection rates. Jeff, I'm sure this is something you've struggled with the domestic front.
Well, first of all, I think that we shouldn't just say this is a problem just for young people. It's a problem for all people.
Yeah.
How do you live your lives in a way that is healthy and minimizes your risk of acquiring any conditions, whether it's HIV or not? The first thing I think everybody need to understand is often the conclusions we jump to is that the people that are getting HIV are doing it because they're doing something wrong or they're misbehaving in some way is often incorrect. So first we need to start there. But you know, we had a conversation earlier about the benefits of biomedical prevention, the benefits of early treatment. One of the ways that we can really make progress is if we get everybody in healthcare and get them so that they routinely see a doctor, they're routinely screened for HIV. Those are things that are going to have a big risk. But there is also a role for just educating people. It's not that people want to get HIV or don't care about getting HIV. Often, the communities that are at greatest risk have less access to effective prevention services and less access to effective healthcare.
Let's go back to our audience to see if there's any additional questions.
Thanks. This has been really wonderful to listen to you all. I'm Darlene Nipper with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and I know Jeff won't be surprised that I'm going to speak to the leadership that I think we agree is needed from the national LGBT organizations. But I also remember when the strategy came out that there was discussion about working more closely with national organizations that focus on communities of color. And I wonder if you could just, Jeff, give us an update on where you think that process is with building prevention and education tools that are focused on communities of color and how those organizations can work with the LGBT organizations to address what I think is still a struggle, which is the stigma associated with black gay men and Latino gay men and bisexual men.
Certainly. Well, I'd start off by saying a couple things. One, at the White House, we don't fund anything. You know, the agencies operate their programs and make decisions. And the second thing is that, you know, the president doesn't believe, and I don't think any of us believe, in picking winners or losers. So it's not as though we focus on a population. I think what we believe is we look at the data we have and look at where the epidemic is. And we believe that because in the United States we don't have what's called a generalized epidemic where people are equally at risk, we have a series of concentrated epidemics. To get the biggest results for all Americans and collectively lower the risk for all Americans acquiring HIV, we've got to focus effectively at the populations at greatest risk. That's a core part of our strategy. So since releasing it, the Department of Health and Human Services, they started to track for the first time when they give away HIV funding, how are they doing on the basis of gender? And how does that match up with the epidemic? On the basis of risk factor, on the basis of race, ethnicity. So that's given us a starting point. And I think the agencies are learning a couple things. In some cases, they're pretty well aligned with the epidemic. In some cases, in particular, with respect to gay men, I think there's been a perception that we've invested a lot of resources in targeting them, and we haven't. The other thing, though, is that you look at our spending of money overall, often a huge share is just focused on the general population, and maybe since we have a series of concentrated epidemics, we can use more of our resources targeted to key populations. Additionally, since this happened, the CDC shifted their funding announcement. So now when we fund health departments, it's based on a new formula based on living HIV cases. Again, that's population neutral, but the populations at greatest risk are going to live in the states with the most HIV. So that's, again, a way that we're going to drive resources to the populations at greatest risk. But a number of agencies have funded different programs, and I can't talk about them or give you all the details, but I know that recently CDC came out with a funding announcement focused on young gay men of color and young transgender men of color. And they really funded that actually to the maximum and tried to really saw this as a major investment and actually go a little further because they thought that working with these groups was really important. Just this week, the CDC launched a Text CMA Makes Us Stronger campaign focused on black gay men, you know, and so it's a beginning of efforts to really focus on this one particular population that's very high risk and really has not received adequate resources or attention.
One more question from our audience.
Thanks. Porter McConnell from Oxfam America. Former President Clinton made an interesting plea this morning at a One Campaign event to investigate the sort of the degree to which country systems are not being used by donors more broadly, and he challenged Congress to think about ways in which our assistance can sort of reach the people we're trying to help most more directly. So I'm wondering if you guys could sort of make the arguments you would make to Congress about why it's important to use more country systems and to fund more local partners directly. Thanks.
Well, I'll start with that. The simple answer is to make these programs sustainable. The United States can't be the ministries of health for 88 different countries in which PEPFAR now is in. But we can work with ministries of health in these countries to expand their capacity, to have the ability to run high quality programs know, most importantly, when they're dropping off in quality and interfaced well with populations in a dialogue, so their ability to self-correct with dialogue from those who use the services continues into the future. Our goal since we have begun with PEPFAR in the Obama administration has been to look for strategies that aggressively expand capacity in ministries of health and in governments and in civil society in the countries in which we work. That process is a difficult one. It is one with a different time frame than an emergency response where you deploy people with expertise on day one into an area to put a capability immediately in play. But it is a process that we know will ensure that these services are there for the duration.
I'd only add a couple things to that. I think the first argument I would make is that it actually works. And, you know, President Obama recently, I think as you know, signed a free trade agreement with South Korea. And one of the points that was made there and has been made since is that South Korea was an aid recipient. And now South Korea is an aid donor. The president spoke about China this morning in the sense that China receives funding from the Global Fund and is in a position now as an emerging market to be providing funding to the Global Fund. So I think part of what we know, and I think we're seeing extraordinary evidence in Africa, including through PEPFAR, is that the more people step up, governments, communities, NGOs, the better the returns are, and quite frankly, the less cost it is for us with all the gains that that brings to bear. But I think the other thing that's important in this is that, you know, if you're a member of Congress, you are rightly thinking, as we think every day in the executive branch, these are taxpayer dollars, and we've got to be responsible for the use of those dollars and have the accountability that is required to continue to make the case to the American people that this is a good and worthy investment. Now, I think the advantage that we have right now is that issues like transparency and accountability have gained enormous currency around the world. They're no longer issues, except in some quarters, where if you talk about them, it's like you're trying to get me or something. There's a demand for it in the way Eric spoke about the demand for accountability from civil society. There's a growing recognition among governments that if you're more transparent and accountable, it's really funny. The country works better. There's a convergence, not 100% the same, but significantly overlapping between developed and developing countries on the importance of transparency and accountability. So I think that's got to be the other side of the equation, is we've got to be able to show that these are good investments, that we can account for the resources, and that we can get the returns.
Well, let's close today by taking a minute to ask our panel to think forward. You talked about what you've seen personally over these last 30 years. Dr. Goosby talked about being in San Francisco in 1981 at the beginning of when this epidemic when the public became aware of it. Gail, you talked about a time when the goal was just to get leaders to acknowledge AIDS, period, and begin talking about it. We've come a long way. There's so much more to do. What are milestones you're looking forward to? When will we be back in this room with that next milestone to talk about? And as you're addressing our audience today, people who want to make a difference, people who want to be a part of this, what advice would you give them?
I alluded to it earlier in that we have started something that we know we won't finish, mm-hmm. but that others will finish behind us. The future is a world without AIDS, without morbidity from other diseases. And I know that the President and the Secretary of State hold that vision, where the playing field is equal, and opportunity and the ability to pursue and achieve your potential is available to all, that countries need to invest in their people to achieve that through education and health as kind of the foundation of that equal playing field, that countries that are further along, developed countries, have an obligation, because we can, to help those countries move in that direction, We need to support them, not supplant them in that effort. And I believe that the United States by far is at the forefront of that idea and implementing and delivering that idea.
Thank you. Jeff?
So I could answer your question a couple ways. I mean, you sort of asked for milestones. And, you know, this summer in July will be the second year anniversary of the National AIDS Strategy's release. It's also when the world will be coming to our backyard for the International AIDS Conference. So I think that presents a natural milestone. But our strategy itself set five-year targets and quantitative goals. So there are ways that we're going to measure our progress. But, you know, and the president mentioned this in his remarks this morning, the vision for our strategy is that new infections will be rare and all people will have unfettered access to high-quality, life-extending care, free from stigma and discrimination. And one of the things that I worry about is that we now have the tools. We can get there. Will we? And, you know, we have major health disparities in this country. And some groups, as some of the conversation alluded to, some groups benefit from services far more than others. So I think one of the things we really need to keep focus on is making sure that everybody comes along, and that we really narrow some of these disparities, whether it's the 2% of people in the United States that are gay men, that are 2/3 of new infections. Can we narrow that? Can we really lower these new infections among young black gay men, but also black women, you know, that are almost 60% of new infections, and really looking at these disparities across a variety of groups. So again, we all can move forward, and you know, we're not leaving just certain groups behind.
Excellent. Gail?
I think the milestones I would look for is where are we going to be and where do we need to be in terms of this continued bipartisan, nonpartisan consensus that this is something that America ought to do, does well, and should keep on doing. I think that's maybe more of a marker than a milestone, but it's certainly been a force multiplier in terms of what we've been able to do. I think the second is, I mean, when I think about this, where it started and as a development issue. You know, it started out where there were donors and then there were these recipient countries. And what we've seen is something that's going like this, where you've still got donors, but the leadership that we have seen in the developing world is extraordinary. And there's a bit of a leveling of the playing field. There still needs to be that resource transfer because we've got richer countries and poorer countries. But the playing field in terms of political and community leadership is rather extraordinary, and so I think we really want to see a truly level playing field. I think the other milestone is to maintain the investments in science, because you know there's been a real surge over the last decade in terms of global HIV and AIDS, and look what we've learned, and look what we've done. Some of those investments were made a long time ago, some more recently, so I think the next milestone, or one of them, will be about or continued learning and incorporating that knowledge to do better and to do more. The last thing I'd say in terms of your question about what people can do, I think there are any number of things, from joining an organization to dedicating your life to this, to contributing money, to making sure that you're more aware of the stigma that you talk about, and that you know, and if you know that someone around you is HIV positive, that you make sure that you're on the right side of that issue. And just to remember that it doesn't really matter how big or how small your contribution is. We got here today because of some really, really big contributions, but literally millions of small contributions. So don't think that anything's too small. Do what you can, do what you will, and it'll help us get there.
Excellent. It really is one of those stories, examples of how all those pieces come together. You can't point out any single one as the answer,
right,
but every piece came together. Well, really want to thank our panel today for your contributions to this milestone that we're at today, to the dedication to the work that's ahead of us. Thanks to our audience who is here today and your great questions, and to everyone who's participating online. Thank you so much.